On this week's program, David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to three cutting-edge events happening simultaneously over the coming weeks in Philadelphia: the Crossing Choirs Month of Moderns Festival, Bowerbird's Festival of Morton Feldman, including the composer's six-hour string quartet, and the Opera Company of Philadelphia's U.S. premiere of Hans Werner Henze's Phaedra. We speak with Christopher O'Reilly, pianist and host of the popular national radio program From the Top, and Susan Lewis takes us to the Mutter Museum at the storied College of Physicians of Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Though the traditional classical music season is coming to a close, it turns out that the most extreme is yet to come, in events opening in three consecutive days next weekend. The Opera Company of Philadelphia's U.S. premiere of Phaedra, the Hans Werner Henze Opera, the Crossing Choir's Month of Moderns, and American Sublime, a festival dedicated to the composer Morton Feldman, organized by Bowerbird, the Philadelphia-based presenter of eclectic music and interdisciplinary events. Usually Philadelphians have to go to New York City for modern music such as this, but it's here, and the Philadelphian Choir's David Patrick Stearns spoke to participating composers and performers who described fringes that the annual Fringe Festival didn't know existed.
How did this happen? How could it happen? Those two simple questions, applied to the forthcoming perfect storm of new music events, says a lot about what Philadelphia was and is. This was always a town where low rents and enlightened philanthropy allowed a certain amount of music to be made whether or not all that many people wanted to hear it. But there's nothing marginal about the 7 concerts in 8 days in the Feldman Festival, the climax of which will be the composer's 6-hour string quartet number 2 at the Philadelphia Cathedral. Hans Werner Henze's fierce, formidable opera arrives at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theater, whose cozy environs will make the story about a mythical queen falling in love with her stepson feel all the more inescapable. And the Crossing Choir is finding new ways to use the human voice, thanks to composers as far away as Latvia. Audience size isn't a sign of success. At the Opera Company of Philadelphia, Phaedra director Robert Driver is after an audience that's engaged.
I don't think it's a question of sales, but I think it's a question also of where is our audience in this voyage of new experiments, you know? And I think we're fine. Would I risk a Henze piece in the Academy? Maybe not now. I mean, you know, actually, I think I would.
And it was only 16 years ago that Driver watched patrons leaving at the intermission of The Rake's Progress, a Stravinsky opera that's now considered a walk in the park. Of course, such events must be planned carefully. Though Phaedra has the excellent Tamara Mumford in the title role, music director Corrado Riveras saw budgetary advantages in an opera that does not require a chorus, a nice coincidence since so many of the opera's chorus members are now rehearsing with The Crossing. For the 3 concerts of all new music, the choir's director Donald Nally has just received Seneca's Zodiac by Erics Essenvolt in Riga, and he's taken with what he sees.
Erics has focused on this moment at the very end when the Zodiac is falling out of the sky into the sea. And in it, he's such a nerd. He's calculated how to use certain pitches at certain moments where he's actually drawn the constellation in the score, connecting certain pitches that he'd calculated to draw this crab or goat or, you know, whatever. You won't hear it. It passes by you It's just part of the technique that he used to compose the end of the piece.
The purpose of such esoteric practices is to take composers to places they wouldn't normally go, turn to the Feldman Festival, and one encounters a composer late in life, throwing off preconceived ideas and becoming obsessed with the most fundamental aspects of music, as if putting them under a microscope. So intuitive was his process that even he couldn't explain himself very well. Conductor Michael Tilson Thomas recalls a conversation with Feldman prior to his 1987 death, in which the composer could only say things like, "I've got this chord." In some works, you're lucky if you get even that. With so few notes of content, the main thing left is time, or Feldman's version of that, says Bowerbird's Dustin Hurt.
He has this absolutely commanding control of the psychology of where the listener is in the piece, and you'll be in a musical section that will repeat and push you to the point of madness. Like you can't hear it anymore. You can't hear that lilting fragment ever again. And he releases it and changes it just at the right time. And through doing this sort of back and forth, the pushing, the pulling, the playing with your expectation, but denying it, this thing happens where at times what is maybe one page of music seems as if it has lasted 30 minutes, but actually it was only 4 minutes. And sometimes a really fast section will just feel like it's blazing by, but it's actually, you've been listening to 60 minutes.
But where's the emotional content? Pianist Marilyn Nonkin, a Feldman specialist who's performing in the festival, explains it almost as a matter of grieving for sound.
I don't think in terms of a narrative or a certain kinds of conflicts. The piece is about taking, you know, an hour and a half of your life and experiencing something that is very beautiful, which dies away. And there's a kind of tragicness about it.
Feldman also liked music that's very quiet. He believed that instruments are more themselves at the lower end of the volume range. That's why Feldman Festival organizer Dustin Hurt is choosing his venues carefully. Those who heard the Philadelphia Singers perform Feldman's Rothko Chapel a few years ago know that a passing police siren can ruin the whole thing. You have to wonder, though, how music that's long, slow, and quiet appeals to the hipster audience that Hurt has cultivated.
This sort of Twitter fad, this ever-shortening, ever-quick bursts, I think the more we go in that direction, the more we crave kind of the opposite, stillness. When Feldman died, there was, I believe, only 6 LPs of his music available as recordings, and now there's over 100 CDs.
None of these composers take the easy way out, even octogenarian Henze. Between writing the 2 acts of the opera Phaedra, the composer fell ill, so ill that he lapsed into a coma and stayed that way for weeks. And when he came out, the music he wrote wasn't exactly timid, says Opera Company of Philadelphia music director Corrado Riveras.
You can feel that also in the music. There is a big difference. The first one is more classic, in the sense of the balance. In the second act, it's less balanced.
Henze is considered one of the greatest living German opera composers, so that any major premiere sparks off great interest among hardcore listeners. So it is with Phaedra. I've been stopped by acquaintances at Lincoln Center asking about the opera's ticket availability. For all the difficulties in preparing this music, one reward is positive notoriety. Even those who don't hear the music hear about it. Donald Nally has found that to be the case with The Crossing, which has been tapped for a premiere of an important new James Dillon piece at Columbia University's Miller Theater in collaboration with the International Contemporary Ensemble, abbreviated ICE.
People outside of Philadelphia are beginning to realize this. ICE didn't go to an ensemble in New York to ask them to go to Chicago and come to New York. They came here. That's a terribly arrogant thing to say, but it's true. And how does ICE even know we exist, you know? Somewhere out there, somebody's saying, you got to hear what's going on in Philadelphia.
Now that's all very nice, but what counts is the benefits to local concertgoers, and that is deliverance from classical music redundancy, not just because these events are a break from the endless cycle of Tchaikovsky symphonies and Puccini operas, but because they're bound to leave listeners with a new perspective that they can take with them into future seasons. Most classical people know about the kind of music that led up to, say, Mahler and Stravinsky, but how aware are they of how this music continues to impact the future? I'm particularly eager to see how the Feldman Festival changes my world. Feldmanites often talk about liking this or that piece more than others, but I can't think of Feldman in that light. Instead of taking you out of yourself with a welter of notes and an intricate form, Feldman's sparseness, as heard in a string quartet number 2, leaves a wide open space for your own experiences. Which begs the question, is any given Feldman experience about the piece, or is it mostly about you?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Phèdre by Hans Werner Henze opens Friday and runs through June 12th at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts Perelman Theatre. Bowerbird's Morton Feldman Festival opens Sunday with Marilyn Nonken performing Feldman's Triadic Memories at Congregation Rod F. Shalom on North Broad Street in Philadelphia. It ends June 12th with Flux Quartet taking on the composer's monumental String Quartet No. 2 at Philadelphia Cathedral in University City. And the Crossings annual Month of Moderns Festival opening concert is at the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill on Sunday at 4.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Christopher O'Reilly is probably best known as the host of the nationally syndicated radio program From the Top. Featuring the cream of the crop of young classical musicians, the show can be heard Sunday afternoons on WRTI. In addition to his duties as a radio host, O'Reilly is a classically trained pianist who continues to tour and perform regularly. But he isn't just playing Mozart, Debussy or Shostakovich. O'Reilly applies his classical know-how to unexpected repertoire. Originally used as filler between segments and From the Top, and spurred by his fascination with the rock band Radiohead, O'Reilly's classical interpretations of that band's music, as well as the songs of the deceased folk rocker Elliot Smith and the 1970s British singer-songwriter Nick Drake, have been met with both critical and commercial success. In these recordings and in companion recitals, O'Reilly bridges the gap between two very different audiences. When we met, I first asked Christopher O'Reilly why a classical musician would want to interpret rock and pop music.
I don't really approach the arrangements that I do by virtue of any sort of overarching concept. The fact that I ended up doing not one but two Radiohead records of piano arrangements had more to do with the fact that that was just the music in my head, and I was listening to just about, you know, nothing but Radiohead. But at the same time, there were other songs that were really catching my imagination, and I was actually doing other arrangements around the same time as I was doing Radiohead, including Elliot Smith, and including, right at the very beginning of the whole process, Nick Drake. It's just a matter of what song I'm listening to hundreds of times and can't get away from. So it's never really a matter of a project, it's really a matter of just sort of a connection. With me, it's the same connection as it is for any of the classical repertoire that I play. I'm really quite compelled and drawn to particular sort of sensuous harmonic language that I feel is shared by people like Elliot Smith and Dmitri Shostakovich and Claude Debussy and Radiohead and Messiaen and various other people. That and also a sense of textural ingenuity. I've always been drawn to the music of Robert Schumann for the fact that, you know, even if he has hundreds of songs, each song has an accompaniment figure in the piano that is completely indelibly unique to that particular song. Likewise, with Radiohead, for instance, you don't have this sort of wall of sound kind of organization of musical structure. You have five members of the band, each of whom are contributing a particular thread to the overall texture, and that by itself suggests, you know, how one might go about devising a piano version of something like that. And it also gets me out of let's say, like a jazz musician would have certain physical habits at the piano. It draws me out of myself. You know, getting into, for instance, Nick Drake's guitar playing, there are certain patterns that he uses that if I'm trying to be true to them, makes my job easier in terms of, I don't know, making it, you know, unique to Nick Drake and not just a matter of me sort of jangling around it with the patterns of my own hands. Similarly, with Elliot Smith's music, you have a widely diverse body of work between the studio versions of a song and, let's say, the 100 or so live versions of each song that Elliott wrote, and how he made choices, you know, from the studio version, which was largely self-produced with his material, to the solo live performances, in which case, well, you know, he's making choices. You know, what are the elements that are absolutely essential to the song, and so what choices has he made in that circumstance, and how should that affect the way I play it on the piano? There are all kinds of interesting sort of threads that sort of catch my ear and lead me into the song, and then the way through it is always a matter of editing and revision, and of course, you know, because it's not my material, it's my doing the best I can to make the other material come alive.
And is it the case that it's Chris O'Reilly using his language to express Nick Drake, or is Nick Drake teaching you a separate vernacular that in turn feeds into the other music that you play?
Well, I like to think that I'm trying, in the same way that I'm, you know, trying to approach a Beethoven concerto, trying to get inside what, you know, what was in Beethoven's mind, how he eventually, you know, wrote it down, makes a very large difference to me insofar as how far away I ever want to get from that kind of, you know, the law of the line, the law of the, you know, what's on the page. I'm you know, with Nick, I'm trying to understand what he was trying to do and get away from some of the extraneous things, you know, other playing styles that contributed to the album that may not really have been what he had in mind. And there are some pretty, you know, interesting examples of those kinds of disparities that make it really quite inspiring. So yeah, I don't really think of it in terms of doing it my way. It's just, you know, I guess the way that I hear things, the way that I try and emulate certain things that are unavailable to the piano, the way, for instance, you try and approximate the sound of the human voice. I give a large nod to Thelonious Monk in that regard, because a lot of what people refer to as wrong note playing, I try and imagine he was trying to emulate the voice. He was trying to emulate the plaintancy of the saxophone, etc. With Nick Drake, for instance, you know, one of the modes of authenticity that I'm most strict about is the way that he phrased. I mean, he was a remarkable musician in that he sort of was pigeonholed within the folk world. But at the same time, when you actually listen to his vocal phrasing, it's really straight out of the jazz tradition. And so that's an interesting juxtaposition within the style, this man almost singing to himself, but with an exuberance to the harmony and an exuberance to the rhythmic placement and the phrasing within the song that makes it, you know, unique, makes it Nick Drake.
Betty said she prayed today for the sky to blow away, or maybe stay.
But yeah, Riverman particularly, you know, speaks to the jazz sensibility, I think.
Gonna see the Riverman, gonna tell him all I can about the band. On feeling free.
With this wide expanse of interest and of knowledge in all types of musical forms that you have, is there ever a point when the piano becomes restricting? Have you ever thought about perhaps having a larger ensemble? Maybe even think about conducting symphony orchestras,
for instance. I think the piano, you know, part of what I'm doing is sort of showing off the instrument, you know, because I think it is capable of just about anything. I tend to think that what I'm doing is as little a reduction as possible. I'm trying to approximate the same kind of energy and the same kind of excitement that a full band version of any of the songs that I like maintain. But I haven't really felt compelled to make versions for, let's say, piano and orchestra, for instance, because I think historically, inherently, there's a sense of protagonist, antagonist, or protagonist and the Greek chorus, etc., in the same way that you have a Beethoven concerto, that I feel wouldn't serve a Radiohead song terribly well. Even songs like How to Disappear Completely, which have their sort of a quarter tone string haze about them, I suppose could work quite well for piano and orchestra, but there again, the piano, the orchestra would just be mere background, and I like musicians, and I like them to feel engaged and like they're doing something important.
It's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
Christopher O'Reilly. His latest CD, Out of My Hands, features his unique interpretations of songs by rock acts such as Nirvana, Pink Floyd, and The Smiths. Philadelphia's Mutter Museum is not a typical tourist stop displaying artwork or artifacts of culture, science, or history, although it has some of all of these. The museum, now over 150 years old, is popularly known today for its human specimens of medical anomalies, such as the tallest skeleton in North America and its plaster cast of conjoined twins. But its mission extends beyond entertaining the curious public. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the continuing relevance of both the Mutter Museum and its home, the College of Physicians of Philadelphia.
In Center City, Philadelphia, on 22nd Street, stands a stately, Beaux-Arts-style National Historic Landmark, rich with medical history. Inside, an airy marble rotunda is flanked by a large portrait of Dr. Benjamin Rush and a Thomas Aikens portrait of Dr. William Thompson, just two of well over 100 portraits around the building. Off to the left is a parlor and a room with the library of Dr. Samuel Gross, the subject of Aiken's most famous work. Towards the back of the building, beyond the foot of a grand staircase, lives the Mutter Museum. Cradling a two-story atrium, its walls are lined with fine cabinets of oak and glass.
It very much has a 19th-century cabinet of curiosities look.
Mutter director Robert Hicks.
And some of the oldest exhibit furniture in that room dates from the mid-19th century. And in fact, some of that furniture constitute rare artifacts in their own right.
But it's what's in the furniture that's made the Mutter's international reputation. Parts of internal organs soak in jars. A blackened cadaver turned to a soap-like substance stretches out on its resting place under glass. Rows of skulls line shelves like skeletal spectators gazing back at us. The museum began in 1859 when retired surgeon Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter, to better educate physicians about problems they might encounter in practice, donated his collection of anatomical and pathological specimens to the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, where George Woolreich is now president and CEO.
The college was mainly a library and a meeting place for the exchange of scientific papers.
The professional organization had been founded 72 years earlier by a group of doctors, including founding father Benjamin Rush.
The mission was self-education, development of skills, sharing of what were then very rare books.
For nearly two centuries, its primary focus and best-used resource was the library. Longtime college librarian Joan McKenzie, who started in the 70s and retired last year, remembers when the reading room was a hub of activity.
We used to be filled with people before the medical schools built up their libraries. There'd be people in here scanning our stacks of journals just to see what was new.
Today, behind lock and key are seven floors of stacks, home to 350,000 books used for scholarly research. There's Aristotle's works published in 1497, an 1826 anatomy book that belonged to Napoleon's second wife, Empress Marie Louise of Austria. British physician William Harvey's 19th century text explaining how blood circulates in the body, one of three copies in the world, and medical literature from other cultures.
This is a Chinese book on natural history. It was a gift that was given to us by Peter Parker. Lived from 1804 to 1888. He was a noted American medical missionary and a diplomat in China.
As the library's role in updating the profession has waned, the Mutter Museum's public appeal has greatly increased, says Woolreich, due largely to the museum's former director, the late Gretchen Worden, who first actively publicized the place.
It was her belief that by seeing the variety of anatomical expression of our gene pool, one can develop an empathy for what it is to be human and an increased sensitivity and appreciation for how far medicine has come.
Among the Mutter's 25,000 objects, only 10% on view at any one time, some have become famous. The Philadelphia woman whose body turned to soap, the plaster cast of conjoined twins, the Hurdle human skull collection, and the tumor removed in secret from President Grover Cleveland. But that's not all, says Hicks.
We also have an enormous array of different kinds of mounted specimens, sometimes in bottles of liquid, sometimes wax injected with different dyes to show, say, the veins over something else, and wax models showing various kinds of conditions. These taken collectively are an attraction. As we say, disturbingly informative museum. People were interested to see these things that can happen to a human body.
On the day we visit, we run into ophthalmologist Joseph Fishkin from Teaneck, New Jersey, who was drawn to the exhibit on eye pathology.
It's a way of exhibiting that I haven't seen before. Here in one place to have an exhibit that shows the exact description of what each type of eye pathology looks like was really fascinating, and I actually wish I would have seen something like that during my ophthalmology training.
Lawyers Renee Gornall and John Riley from Arlington, Virginia, were just exploring.
It's amazing. It's interesting, and some of it's a little scary, too.
I've never seen anything like it, but he kind of keeps warning me as we go around corners.
While many of the objects are very old, some are quite new. Mutter Communications Director Jay Basil was inspired by the story of Harry Eastlack, who died at age 40 of a bone disease commonly known as FOP and donated his skeleton so others could learn from it. When Basil learned he needed a hip replacement because of the side effects of medication he was taking, he went to then-executive director Gretchen Worden.
And I asked her how many examples they might have of such a condition in the collection. She informed me of none, and I asked her if she would be interested in acquiring one. And after a brief pause, she realized I was talking about my own.
Now Basil's hip is part of the collection.
And if one person looks at that hip and realizes that these medications have a side effect to them and perhaps walks away with a better understanding of this condition, then it's done its purpose.
In its exploration of the human life cycle, the Mutter fits right in with the continuing ethos of the College of Physicians, which today actively works to educate the public.
We're trying to advance the cause of health and remind ourselves and others where medicine came from, what it has achieved, what's left for it to do, and both the honor and the responsibility of being in healthcare.
College programs include a website containing healthcare resources for the Philadelphia region, a center for school groups, and lectures on topics of public concern, from the health consequences of global warming to the recession's impact on healthcare. The college also cultivates a medicinal herb garden in honor of Benjamin Rush. And although it may not be for the squeamish, the Mutter continues to do its part to enlighten the curious, chronicle the human life cycle, and serve as a resource for efforts to improve the human condition.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Mutter Museum is at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia at 19 South 22nd Street. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.